Welcome to the podcast. I'm Angela Beaubier, and this is Life in the Talbot Settlement, brought to you by Tyrconnell Heritage Society, operators of Bacchus Page House Museum. In this series, we will do our best to give you a full appreciation of the history of Western Elgin County in southwestern Ontario, from First Nations to the early settlers to the 1950s. Sit back, relax, and enjoy. Before we begin, I'd like to acknowledge funding from Tyrconnell Heritage Society, operators of Bacchus Page House Museum. Help Bacchus Page House Museum and Tyrconnell Heritage Society fund our archaeological assessment by sponsoring a square. Your donation of $100 will sponsor the excavation of 1 square meter on the grounds of Bacchus Page House Museum. Take part in this exciting project. All donations can be made through our website by clicking the donate button, www.bacchuspagehouse.ca. Welcome to the 52nd episode of the podcast Life in the Talbot Settlement. In this week's episode, we talk about soap and the various ways settlers utilized it, the extensive time and effort that went into simple household tasks like doing laundry, and the trials and tribulations of bathing. And before we begin, I'd like to acknowledge funding from the Department of Canadian Heritage and Tyrconnell Heritage Society, operators of Bacchus Page House Museum. Before we talk about how the early settlers washed their clothes, we must first discuss their clothes. Settlers would have worn a few layers underneath their clothing, and these layers were things like a chemise, drawers or underwear, pantaloons, and more. These were the clothing pieces that were washed most frequently because they were up against your body. Then there was a base layer, for example, dresses, pants, or vests, that would be washed less frequently. And lastly, there were the outside layers, things like aprons. Now these would be washed very frequently, and there's a reason for that. The inside layers of their clothing got the dirtiest, usually, with sweat, while the base layer remained relatively clean because the inside and outside layers would catch all the dirt. But those aprons, they were probably the dirtiest. Soap from the store would have cost a pretty penny, and in some regions, stores may not have been close by. To combat this, the hardworking pioneers had to be resourceful and learn how to make their own soap from wood ashes and waste fats. Only a few basic ingredients were needed to make soap: lye, which is also called sodium hydroxide, or sometimes potash, and animal fat. They realized it was easy to craft soap using the overflowing amount of hardwood ashes that built up in their daily fires, along with the ample amount of animal fat from the butchering of livestock. For a lot of the pioneers, soap making became a semi-annual or yearly affair on the homestead. As the butchering of livestock occurred in the fall, soap was crafted at that time on many farms and homesteads to utilize the abundant supply of lard and tallow. For the homes that did not butcher their livestock for food, soap was generally crafted in the springtime, saving the ashes from the wintertime fires and the cooking grease, which they salvaged throughout the year. Here's a memory from Mrs. James C. Campbell of how her family made soap. Quote, "In my memory, I remember an old leech barrel under the shade of a harvest apple tree. Beside it was a large black iron kettle hanging from a tripod. The lye was poured into the kettle as it ran from the leech. The base of the leech was built up of bricks or stones with the back higher than the front, so that it had quite a slant. A wide board was placed on top with cleats nailed on to hold the bottom of the barrel up a bit so the lye could run out. Cleats were put on the board slanting toward the front so the lye would run into the large wooden pail or crock. The barrel is placed on top of the board. The bottom has holes bored in it in many places. Clean straw is put in the bottom of the barrel. Then the barrel is filled and well packed with hardwood ashes. A well or indentation is left in the top, and you add water. Soft water is the best, from the rain barrel or the cistern. Mother has a steady job emptying the lye and filling the leach barrel with water. Pieces of fat, suet, or any bits of fat saved from cooking during the winter is placed in the kettle. When you have enough lye runoff, you put a fire under the kettle and boil it. The mixture gets thick like jelly. To test to see if it is not too strong, touch some of your tongue. If it smarts, you add more soft water and more fat. Do not allow children to be near as the lye burns." Many farm women made lye and sold it to woolen mills for washing fleece. The soap was stored in wooden barrels for home use. It was used in washing and cleaning. with white sand, lye soap, and a scrub brush, and lots of arm strong power, the maple floor in the kitchen would clean snowy white, end quote. Now that we know how soap was made from that great description, how did they use it? A big part of washing day was the water. Soap needs hot water to work. Therefore, families needed to heat their wash water so that the soap could clean the laundry. Early settlers would have used a large kettle of water boiling over an open fire pit in the warmer months or on the stove over the grate in the house during colder months. This water would be collected from nearby streams or wells or cisterns with the help of shoulder yokes. After the tubs were filled with water and heated, a pan of homemade soap was cut into pieces or chips and added to the boiling water. Clothes were then sorted and soaked in hot soapy water. The whites were washed first, then the colored clothes, and finally the dirtiest clothes. A long stick was used to stir the clothes around in the hot water and to pull the clothes out. After soaking, the clothes were scrubbed on the washboard to remove the dirt. Stains could be taken out before or during the washing process using a variety of methods. Some include milk for ink stains, butter for fruit stains, lemon juice for mildew, and good old handmade soap. The clothing was rubbed up and down on the ridges of the washboard and dipped in water. This process occurred over and over until the clothes looked clean, or cleaner than they previously were anyway. This task was very hard on the arms and fingers, as well as a person's back. There were definitely some stiff backs in the 1800s. Wash water was reused until it was too dirty. Then more clean water had to be heated. To get out the soap suds, the clothes were rinsed in cold water. If more than one rinse was needed, two tubs were used. The clothes were then wrung out by hand or with a wringer. A wringer is essentially a crank that turns rollers and squeezes the water out of the clothes. If the settlers' arms weren't tired enough from the washing process, they would be now, as it required a lot of effort to wring out the clothes or just to turn the crank. Afterwards, the clothing would be hung outside to dry in the sun. Sounds easy, right? Not all their clothing could be simply thrown into the boiling water. Some fabrics could not be boiled, or it would ruin the clothes. Take wool, for example. Many of the settlers' clothing was made out of wool, which couldn't be boiled. When washed in hot water, wool usually turns into a hard, felt-like fabric if not washed rapidly in cool water. To complicate things even more, the clothing that they wore was handmade and hand-dyed, meaning that the colors in their clothes could sometimes run when they scrubbed and washed it. Therefore, all the clothing would have to be sorted and washed separately based on the colors. All the light-colored clothing, like white, light pink, light blue, was washed at once, after which the dark-colored clothes, like dark brown, blue, and black, could be washed. After all the clothes had been washed and dried, there were bound to be wrinkles. These were easily rid of with the help of settlers' trusty irons. Sad irons, also known as flat irons, were a common household item in the 1800s. The name comes from the Middle English word solid, and just like its name, these irons were made of around 5 to 9 pounds of solid cast iron. The triangular shape of irons aided in getting around buttons. To use these handy tools, they would simply be placed into a stove or on top of the fire and heated up. The temperature was very important. If it was too cold, the iron would not get the wrinkles out, and if it was too hot, it could scorch the clothing. Once the iron was at the perfect temperature, it was quickly taken out and used on the desired clothing piece, which sat atop a wooden ironing board. This whole ordeal had to be done quickly due to the loss of heat. You may be thinking, how was this done safely if the whole iron, including the handle, was made of solid cast iron? Well, the answer is, it wasn't done safely. Not by today's standards, anyways. Many fingers and hands were often burnt. To try and avoid this, rags were used to retrieve the hot and heavy iron from the stove. Even putting the iron down was no easy task. Iron trivets were made to house the hot irons during and after the chores. At Bacchus Page House Museum, we have a wooden ironing board with a suspicious scorched triangle. The person who used this board definitely needed an ironing trivet. As if the settler woman needed more to do, they also had to keep irons clean and smooth. Otherwise, soot could be deposited onto the freshly hand-washed laundry. Did I also mention they needed to be greased to prevent rust and stains? Now back to some easier chores, if there were any. With their homemade soap, settlers not only cleaned their clothing, but themselves, and even used it as a lubricant for wagon wheels. Let's talk a bit about how the settlers bathed. Bath day came once a week in the wintertime. In the summer, settlers maybe rinsed off in nearby creeks or rivers prior to bath day. It was a lot of work to get enough water to fill a bathtub and heat it up. That's because, just like washing the clothes, the water they were hauling would have had to come from the well or a nearby stream, and would be cold depending on the season. Another reason the settlers didn't bathe very often was because of a popular myth at the time. Some people believed that taking a bath would get rid of all the protective oils on their skin, and if they didn't have these oils, they were at an increased risk of getting sick. Since taking a bath was so laborsome, and they didn't believe in taking baths often, to feel clean, the settlers washed their faces and hands in a basin of cold water each morning and night. Sounds refreshing, except cold water doesn't usually kill germs. When the settlers did take baths, they would have had a metal or wooden tub, likely the same one they used for the laundry day, meaning this tub was not very wide or deep, and bathrooms were not a thing. Instead, bathtubs were placed in the kitchen so they could be close to the stove. It'd be close to the fire, which made it easier to fill up the tub, as well as keeping each person warm after they got out. Enough water would be heated to fill the tub, then they would proceed to bathe. And by filling the tub, I mean a few inches. The entire family often used the same water. It would be too time-consuming and laborious to empty the tub and refill it for every member of the family. The father would go first and use the cleanest water, then the mother, followed by all of the children, one at a time, oldest to youngest. There is a saying that you might have heard that goes, "Don't throw the baby out with the bathwater." This is because the youngest children would get to take their baths last, so the water would have been very dirty. The saying developed as a funny way to remind parents that the baby could still be in the tub. I get it. Chores, no matter what they entail or how long they take, are always annoying to do. However, consider how fortunate we are for all the technological advancements making it easy for us to complete all these tasks. Please share the podcast with your friends and follow us on all social media platforms at Backus Page House. The Backus Page House Museum and Turkana Heritage Society acknowledges the land we are on today as the traditional territory of First Nations people. As settlers at a settler-focused museum, we value both the significant historical and contemporary contributions of all original peoples and ask how we can be supportive in Indigenous cultural renewal. Life in the Talbot Settlement is a production of Turkana Heritage Society, operators of Backus Page House Museum. Your host has been Angela Bobier. Music provided by Jack Whitmer. And thanks to our producer, Caitlin Rietzma. To make a charitable donation, become a Turkana Heritage Society member, and to contact the Backus Page House Museum, please visit our website, www.backuspagehouse.ca. Thank you again for listening. Help Backus Page House Museum and Turkana Heritage Society fund our archaeological assessment by sponsoring a square. Your donation of $100 will sponsor the excavation of 1 square meter on the grounds of Backus Page House Museum. Take part in this exciting project. All donations can be made through our website by clicking the donate button, www.backuspagehouse.ca.